Hi, this is Kurt Smith from Tears for Fears, and you're listening to Mr. Media Radio. Better you than me.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to legendary rock and roll singer Gary Anderson, who you'll probably know better as Gary U.S. Bonds. That's right, the man who really got the party started with New Orleans and Quarter to Three is my guest. He's just published a memoir of his life and career titled By U.S. Bonds, That's My Story, written with Stephen Cooper. And the foreword is by Little Stephen Van Zandt of the E Street Band. Stick around. There might be a reference or two in the conversation that follows to another member of the E Street Band, if you play your cards right. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. The show is brought to you today by Amazon.com, the world's greatest store for everything from books and movies to computers, TVs, and even my favorite soft drink, Pepsi Wild Cherry. Thinking about buying something online from Amazon or just want to do a little window shopping? You can save yourself a lot of money and help support Mr. Media, that's me, by clicking on one of the Amazon ads at MrMedia.com and start your shopping with us. Get yourself the new iPad or Kindle Fire. Feeling a little racy today? Amazon's got what you need to feel exciting and new, as they used to sing on The Love Boat. Remember, start your next shopping trip from the comfort of your own home, car, hotel, or office with Amazon.com at MrMedia.com. That's right, MrMedia.com. And folks, thanks for your support. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of people who claim to know the actual words to Louie Louie, but probably stand a better chance of knowing who Daddy G is in Quarter to Three in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Here's a story you don't know about a man whose music you do know. Norfolk, Virginia's favorite and the Jersey Shore's adopted son, Gary U.S. Bonds. Now, I just finished reading By U.S. Bonds, That's My Story. It's the kind of book we need more of, one that tells what happens to a performer that rockets to fame and what happens to them when the Klieg lights are turned to the next superstar. In the case of Bonds, who was born Gary Anderson, he was a recipient of a second shot at the brass ring 20 years after he first hit it big with hits such as New Orleans and Quarter to Three, thanks to the admiration and attention of New Jersey's favorite son, Bruce Springsteen. Now, if you follow pop music, or Springsteen in particular, you already know how Springsteen and Little Stephen Van Zandt, helped Bonds return to the recording studio and the Hot 100 after a two-decade absence. But what interested me in By U.S. Bonds is the way these men stayed in the life of Bonds and his family. And family, by the way, is a recurrent theme in this memoir, starting with Bonds' devotion to his mother and then to his wife and daughter. And we'll definitely talk about that, too. Gary U.S. Bonds, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hey, glad to be here.
Delighted to meet you. Yeah, big treat for me. Thank you.
I'm waiting to hear this story. Sounds interesting.
Well, I could pick it up and start reading it to you. I have a copy right here. Reading your autobiography, I think the thing that really struck me was how little I, and I assume other people, know about your generation of performers. I read Chuck Berry's memoir. I read Keith Richards' memoir. I think I read one by Little Richard, but there must be a whole oceans of great stories out there just begging to be told.
Oh, I'm sure there are. I mean, I listen to a lot of them on the tour bus. You know, I don't know why everybody didn't put it down on paper. Well, I know why I didn't. I had to be coaxed into it by Stephen, and thank God he did, because, I mean, I probably never would have done it if he hadn't just pressured me. Come on, we got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. And finally, I just had enough beer, and I went, okay, let's do it.
why, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I make my living helping other people write books and tell their stories. But mm-hmm. I can't imagine ever being in the position of telling my own story. Just you give up that last vestige of privacy to some degree. I mean, was it hard to tell your story?
In the beginning, when we started out, I mean, just the initial, let's get started, that was the hardest part. After I got into it, I really enjoyed it. I began to realize how much fun I've really had in these last 50, 60 years, you know, doing this. I got back to going back to Norfolk, Virginia, mm-hmm. and got back with some of my friends that I really love and adore still, but I just never got back to seeing them again, you know. We gained new friends when I moved up to New York and kind of forgot about my old ones. My old ones are all right. They were pretty cool. And I got to see them again, and we got to share the old stories and, you know, sit down and have a couple of cocktails and lie about all the women we used to know and how pretty they were. And the more we drank, the better looking the women got. And it was a really, really cool experience. And I'd like to do it again if I had another life. Mm.
So, you wound up using it as kind of an excuse to reestablish old ties and catch
yeah.
up. And I'm sorry?
And remember, that was the main thing. You know, there are a lot of things you forgot. My friends reminded me of. Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that, you know. What a great memory, you know. And it's good to go back. It's good to go back.
Did any of your friends remember any of your history differently than you did, and you had to maybe kind of square the two stories?
Oh, they all did.
All right.
Well, that happens with everything. You yeah. know, you can tell a lie now, and in 10 or 15 years, you start believing it. You know, you tell that story again, and you knew it was a lie, but did that really happen or not? I don't know, you know? But no, it was fine.
And did you have any trouble? I noticed this with people that I've worked with, where they have a little. You when you get questioned about certain things that happen in your life, you kind of realize, yeah, maybe I don't want to share every story. Were there stories that you chose not to share?
I don't believe so. So far, there hasn't been. I'm sure there are some that are hidden in the back of my head here somewhere. You know, but no one's been able to jar them loose so far. You know, maybe you will today. No, I'm pretty open anyway. I'm pretty much, you know, I don't care kind of guy.
Well, there is one thing I want to ask you about, and I'm not necessarily asking you to get this story, but it seemed like you went from living at home with your mom, and then the next thing we knew, you were married. There must be kind of a little gap in there in terms of, women in your life. I mean, I don't want to be Howard Stern here, but we don't even learn how and if you ever lost your virginity, for example.
I never did.
Little Mama's Immaculate Conception, right?
Oh, yes, she is. Yes, she is. No, there were a bunch of little... There were a bunch of girlfriends, you know, back in there. We didn't mention them because I didn't want to get into all of that. There was nothing bad about it or anything. Mm-hmm. Just your typical, yeah, boy had a girlfriend had a boyfriend, you know. I wasn't, even though I was known to be a womanizer, I really wasn't, you know. I really wasn't. I was just a kid that a lot of the girls like, and I knew that, but I didn't take advantage of that. I was always respectful to the girls and the ladies, you know, and I didn't try to take advantage of them. Wasn't looking for anything. Main thing I was looking for was attention from them, mm-hmm. you know, and I got a lot of that, you know, but I had so much love for my family and so much I wasn't striving for love. Just attention from pretty girls.
God love them too. And you got married. You got married very young.
Yeah, well, I got married when I was about 23 years old. But I'd been on the road for a few years by then. Mm. And then when I saw her in a nightclub, and you know, I told my friend, who was my road manager, called Slow Drag. And I said, that's the girl I'm going to marry. And, that's the one.
Now,
and since we've been married 50 years now.
So. I was going to say, now, since she was a singer herself and she was on the road, you would think she would know better, right, than to go with another singer? Isn't that like asking for trouble?
Well, I don't know. She saw the real me, you know. I like to think of it that way, you know. And I saw her as just a very talented, very beautiful woman that I would like to spend the rest of my life with. And so far I have.
So far?
Yeah, well, you know, we still got another 50 to go, maybe. Oh,
okay. Yeah, I know. I just celebrated 25 with mine about 2 weeks ago, and someone said to me, "Oh, this is great! I can't wait to come back and for your 50th anniversary party." And I said, "Well, wait a minute! I invested 25 in this one. I think it's time to find another one for the next 25." And
yeah, right.
I got lightly slapped for that. I don't know.
Oh, no! Luckily, you got lightly slapped.
Yeah. Well, and that wasn't even my wife who slapped me. This other woman didn't appreciate it. This type of story, what I was kind of curious, all the people you've known over the years who, you know, whose careers have risen and fallen, and not many of them have risen again like yours has, who else's story would you like to read in this type of format?
Let's see. I'd like to see what really happened with the guys like Little Richard, you know, And I still don't know the whole story of the beginning of Chuck Berry, you know, even though I get a lot of stories from Danny G. Mm-hmm. He kind of knew all those guys back then because they were on the same label with him, with Chess and right. Chess Brothers and all that. So he tells me a lot of things, you know. But I talked a lot, I used to talk a lot with Chuck Berry, never really had enough time to sit down with him and find out exactly what happened, you know. I think he'd be interested.
I agree. And,
you know?
Well, now unless I'm wrong, he did, maybe I'm thinking of Little Richard's book. One of them did a really interesting memoir, but it, like in Chuck Berry's case, I'm with you. I mean, I'd love to know, like the modern Chuck Berry is this guy who shows up for gigs, plays with whatever band shows up behind him, wants his money up front, wants it in cash, right? And then he's gone. And I just kind of wondered what happened in his career that caused him to become that guy over the later years. Is it from being ripped off so much by promoters? Is that the kind of thing?
He got screwed a lot. I mean, he told me that he got screwed a lot back then, and he vowed to never get screwed again. Mm. And so far, it looks like he's perfected that part. You know, he doesn't take anything.
Yeah.
You know, he's the screwee now.
I like that. I like that. He would probably really appreciate that. That's good. Yeah. Anybody else? Did your friend Benny King, did he ever tell his story?
I don't believe he has. I don't believe he has. And his was pretty interesting, you know, but it started with the Drifters, you know, basically. You know, I mean, I know he had some, it was with a couple other groups before that. We talked a lot when we were in England together. And he did tell me the name of the group, but this Alzheimer's doesn't work for me well. And but yeah, I remember it. But you know, I'm not a reader. I'm really not a reader. I will not pick up a book and start reading about somebody. Mm. I'd rather sit down and talk with them if I can. You know, if I can. But for me to sit and read, I don't know. My mind just switches too quick. I'm off to something else after the fifth page, you know.
Were there? I mean, we'll probably talk a little bit about, you know, how you got screwed by promoters and by your original record company. But I mean, as you look back, can you think of any African American performers of that era, the '60s, who did not get screwed, who had good financial advice and good, you know, that came out of that hole, or is it just was it pretty much everybody?
It was pretty much everybody, you know. I mean, African American, Caucasian, Mexican, whatever you were, you were in the music business, you got screwed because there were no rules, and there still aren't any rules. Mm. You know, to this day, there's still no concrete like a carpenter has rules. You know, whoever has rules, music business really that they have. Sketchy rules. Hmm. You can do this, maybe. And this might work somehow. You know, it's not concrete. You know, how do you get your money? Well, you know, you hope for it. I guess, I don't know. But, I mean, they got the unions of all types, you know, but they're different. Mm-hmm. And to go in there and try to figure out how you're supposed to get your money, it's like, You got to be a rocket scientist, you know, or a good lawyer. One or the other. And then they fight.
Yeah.
You know, to this day, they fight.
A couple months ago, I had on a guy. Do you remember the band, the Cowsills, the family?
Oh, sure.
Right?
One of them was here one day, many years ago.
Well, Paul Cowsill came on the show to talk. Showtime ran a documentary about their family and how it all went to hell. And it was really interesting to me in that, I mean, it was just as sad a story as any I've heard from that era. But he told me how the kids thought that they had these trusts set up because they're all underage and that money was being put aside from them. And so when the first one hit 18, he went to his parents and said, "Where's my trust fund?" "Well, you don't have a trust fund." There was this whole belief that in Hollywood, you know, the kid actors, they had to have trust funds set up for them because of Jackie Coogan, the law out there. But that didn't apply to the music business. So all these kids in this family thought that they were going to have trust funds. Their parents spent every money of it. I mean, so every minute, every penny of it. And it's just it's just hard to fathom how people got so screwed, even by their own family.
But and that's getting back to my point. There are no rules in the music business. There still aren't any rules there, you know? And you're still going to get screwed.
Well, and I'm sure because you're promoting the book, you're having to talk about this a bit. But the you got screwed in 60-61 dealing with Legrand and Frank I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name.
Frank Guida.
And that screwing continued not just through the 60s but into the 70s and on. How on earth does that happen? I mean, he got hold of royalties from you from the EMI America when you did Dedication, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, we're still trying to figure, and the lawyers are still trying to figure that out, how that happened. And the fact was, when I first lost the first lawsuit, you know, which was I just didn't want to record for LeGrand anyway. I got tired of doing those stupid, silly records that they wanted me to do. I wanted to be a more, you know, I wanted to be an artist. I didn't want to be a comedian, you know. So I just stopped recording, and then that kind of screwed things up, you know, because I wasn't abiding by their contract, you know. So they sued and won that. But in that, there was some kind of clause that said that in my future writings and so forth would also be involved. I don't know how that got in there to this. And at the time that I got sued, I didn't have enough money to fight. And I was fighting one of the largest lawyers in New York. I think it was Grubman, the law offices of Grubman and somebody. And they were like the biggest ones in New York City. And I had $5, you know, whatever I'm going to fight with. So I just kind of went in. And even the judge himself, he says, you know, this is actually a shame. He said it in court. He said, this is a shame that things like this have to happen to these artists, you know. He says, but unfortunately, I got to side with Grubman. It's the only way. But it's on the manuscript. Okay.
It figures we would lose the connection as you're talking about being screwed by.
The screwing never stops.
No, I know. It really doesn't. And you know, the thing that struck me is, I mean, people think when they buy records over the years that, you know, a piece of that's going to the artist. And I'm sure word didn't get out until very late, I guess, that you weren't getting a piece of that. And even to read it in the book that after Dedication, you were still getting screwed. I mean, it's just – let me tell you. I went on iTunes this weekend and downloaded a bunch of your records, and I hesitated to do it because I thought this money probably is not even going to reach him.
Yeah.
How is that? It's just not right.
Well, it's not right. You know, I stopped worrying about that, you know, 40 years ago. You know, because I do it. I figured in my life, I myself in my head, I'm talented enough to make this thing work no matter what. One record doesn't stop this whole show.
Yeah.
I got 1,000 of them ready, you know. And so, you know, one day I'll just get lucky and get to keep all of it.
I hope that happens for you, my friend.
I hope so, too, you know.
And so let me ask you this. Is it a different era now? Do you have a sense that, you know, young people starting out in the business, that they have any better financial arrangements or understanding of intellectual property than you did 50 years ago?
Oh, yeah, they certainly do now. Because they're more aware of that you got to have somebody to represent you. You know, you can't do it. It looks easy. You can't do it on your own. You know, and you find you're a good lawyer, and there are good lawyers out there now. You know, that's not working for the big corporation. They'll work for you, you know, and they're not trying to rob you, you know. Of course, you still have to look around for them, but there's a lot of them now, you know. There's more of them good ones now than there are bad ones. So, yeah, and all the new kids now, we as artists, older artists, we tell them, no, do this. Go get you this guy. I know this guy. Call this number. Mm-hmm. You know, and work it out with him and try to help him as much as you can, you know. That's all we can do.
Well, let's talk about a happier time. You tell the story in the book about your first meeting with Springsteen in Hazlitt, New Jersey, I think it was.
It was Hazlitt, yeah.
And you were the last one in the room to kind of recognize the significance of that first meeting, weren't you?
Yeah, I had no idea who he was, because being on the road at the time, I was laughingly recalled that doing the Holiday Inn tour, you know, because I was working at all these hotels, the Holiday Inns, the Hiltons, whoever had a lounge, that's where I'd be, you know, doing an oldie show, as they call it. I think they still call it that now. And that was kind of fun. So I wasn't listening to a lot of radio. I was too busy just learning what I had to do to make this crowd happy in Milwaukee at this night in this Holiday Inn, you know? What songs do they like in this one? Not new songs. What old songs do they like here? You know, and I'd look up the old charts in that area to see what they were playing on the older radio stations to see if they, okay, we got to do this, they have, you know, get a list of songs like that to keep working. And it worked, you know. It was a good idea. It worked for me, so I didn't get a chance to hear the new guys coming out, the Springsteens, and I knew Bob Dylan, but you know, I didn't like him. So.
Fair enough.
So it didn't bother me, you know. And the Jackson Browne, I had no clue as to who these people were until he came in that place that night, and actually. Two of his friends and him, and one of them came up to me and said, look, we got a friend of ours out there really likes your music. He'd like to come up and do a song with you. And I thought that was a pretty cool thing to have him come up, anybody come up, give him a chance, you know, to go to the bar and get a beer and hang out, you know, let somebody else do the work for me. and I says, okay, well, what's how? And I did. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, here's a friend of mine here in the audience like to sing a song here, Mr. Bruce Springsteen. The crowd went, wow. You know, and I'm going, oh, who the hell is this guy?
What's the big deal?
Somebody know it. Bruce Springsteen. What is that? Very popular guy here in town. And he got up and started singing. We had a blast, man. He was such a sweet, sweet, nice, talented man. You know, we sat there. I think I played that last set for about an hour and a half. I was only supposed to do 40 minutes. So the promoter was happy, you know. The club owner, manager was happy. And selling a lot of beer, a lot of drinks. And we had a blast. We became friends that night, you know. And to this day, we still remain friends.
Well, and that's the thing that really struck me in the book, because I knew, and I mentioned this in the introduction, most people, I think, know this part of your story and his story, that, you know, you had that chance meeting with him, I think a couple of years later, he and Stephen Van Zandt got involved with you, they produced and wrote a lot of songs for Dedication, you got back on the charts, This Little Girl Is Mine, and but what I kept wanting to read... And it was interesting because I kept thinking, okay, I'm going to turn the page and I'm going to be disappointed. Because I was sure that at some point Springsteen and Van Zandt drop out of your life. I thought, how could they How could they possibly stay involved? These guys are trotting all over the world. They've always got guest stars coming up. They do this, yeah. They do that. And damned if I wasn't shocked to read that over the course of the years, they stay involved with you. They got involved with the second record, of course, after Dedication. And then yeah. On through the years. And then all the way up to present time, the Wrecking Ball tour at MetLife Stadium, right? I mean...
Got up, did a couple of days there. He's a pretty cool guy, you know, and he's not going to leave me, I hope, because he still owes me $5, you know.
Oh, does he?
I'm going to keep him around till he pays me. And Steve Manzett, I don't know, he's been owing me for life.
What is it, why do you think that the relationship between you and these guys has stuck, whereas... I'm sure, and I know, I mean, from, you know, following them for years, that, you know, they're always involved with different musicians. They always, you know, they love music, and they have a lot of respect for older artists, people who preceded them. Why you? Why do you think you connected with them so well and for so long?
I don't know, but I guess I relate to them. We share the same likes, dislikes musically. I don't know, you know, and they're all nice people. We do the Christmas shows every year together too, in Jersey, mm-hmm. for the same organizations we do it. And I guess basically it's me, Bruce, Bon Jovi, Southside Johnny, you know, Bobby Bandiera, and every year we do the Christmas shows there and raise a lot of money for. Bunch of nice kids, you know, and we get together, we have dinner together, we share our little stories again. I guess that's it, you know, and we don't get to see each other all year. Mm. It's periodically, once every 3, 4, 5 months, and that's enough.
And you had a separate relationship with the late Clarence Clemons as well, right?
Yeah, well, Clarence is originally from my hometown, he's from Virginia. And even though we didn't know each other in Virginia then, but I met him a couple of times there, but I really didn't know him there until I got to Jersey. That's when I finally sat down when we talked a lot, you know, and got to know each other. Mm. He was a cool guy. He was a cool, cool guy.
I have a Clarence Clemons story. He appeared with the Red Bank Rockers in Orlando many years ago, and I was a music critic, and I went. I went to the show and had requested an interview with him afterwards, and I waited, I don't know, 3-4 hours outside of his tour bus. The manager kept coming out and saying, yeah, he's going to do it in a little bit, and he's going to do it in a little bit, and I'm waiting and waiting. It was the most patient I would be for anybody. And I did. I had my original copy of Born to Run with me. I thought at the very least I'm going to get this damn thing signed. And so the tour manager finally comes out about 3:30 in the morning and said, look, I'm really sorry, but he's just too tired now. And I'm like, yeah, of course he is. It's been 4 hours. I said, look, can you at least do me this? Can you just get my album signed? And because I'd waited. So I got that. But and the reason I thought of this was when I downloaded a couple of your songs over the weekend, one of the related suggestions was for Clarence Clemons and the Red Bank Rockers. And I'm trying to remember the name of the album. And I went and I downloaded all of those too because I hadn't had those. I never had those digitally. So I had a great old time yesterday listening to you and Clarence. And, you know, good stuff.
There's a lot of fun stuff in there. It really is. I enjoy it.
So what does Springsteen and what does Van Zandt, what do they know? I mean, you've been in the studio a lot over the years. You've been in the studio with them, though, several times. What do these guys know about music and production and engineering that maybe other people don't? They obviously know something that's special.
I think it's just they know how to have fun in there, you know? And it's not as serious, you know? It's only rock and roll, you know? It's not that serious, mm-hmm. you know? It's not life or death or anything. If you can find a song that fits you, that you can sing, and you can just sit there with the other guys, and you don't need charts, you don't need all of that other crap, you know, you can just go in and go, I think if we do this, we can, you know, that's fun to me. That's fun to me. And they, that's the way they were. Mm-hmm. I mean, but when we first started, Bruce sat in there with this little girl. He did one whole day, starting at, I think we started something like 11 o'clock until like 9 o'clock that night, with the snare drum. Hmm. And me and Steve were sitting around, and we going, what's wrong with him? Then finally we went, Bruce, what are you looking for? So I'm looking for that sound. I go, well, you planning on finding it today, tomorrow, this week or something? Forget about it. It's a snare drum, you know. We could change it in the mix, you know. And finally, I think he got it. We wound up using the snare drum that we did on the first take, which was Max's snare drum. Mm-hmm. He must have gone through 50, 60 snare drums that day. We wound up back with Max's snare drum, and we used it in every session. Same snare drum. And to this day, I ask him about it, and he just shrugs me off. Why were you sitting there trying all these? He goes, I don't know, I was looking for something. Okay.
Wow.
But then we got back to having fun. But see, when you get hooked into something like that, that takes all the fun out.
Yeah.
You know? Once we got back to having fun, we started having hits.
Well, let me bring this all back around to family before we kind of wrap up. And I get the sense that you think of those guys as family at this point. They've certainly meant a lot to you. But let's talk about your own family. You married a singer. Your daughter, Lori, Little Mama.
Yeah.
Little Mama. apparently, he's got a great voice too. Sings.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose you've been able to sustain family and marriage and closeness to both the women in your life for so long and without a lot of the bumps that a lot of guys in your industry have hit over the years?
Well, you know, they're in the band, you know. My wife and my daughter.
Well, that would make it even tougher, I would think.
No, I mean, that's great. You know, I'm on the road, you know, and we're having a great time together, you know. We see. We know what each other is doing, so we can't be jealous. So, you know, and we got to protect Little Mama for many years, you know, from all the low lives. So now she's married to a very sweet, sweet young man, you know, and I think that worked out good for her, you know. All of a sudden, at the wedding, he got up and tried to sing, and I went, oh, God, no. We don't need another one. And it's just that we love each other, you know, a lot, you know, and we understand each other. You know, like I keep telling my wife, she gets mad every now and then. Well, not really mad, but so I've known you long, and I've known my mother.
Oh, wow, good point.
Yeah, right.
Good point. Wow. Well, and you were very close. Is she off to the side there? Is that why you keep looking at?
Yes, she just walked in.
Oh, hi.
She's checking to see who's in there with me.
Oh, just me on the computer. Gary's pretend friend on the computer.
Yeah, right.
Well, so, listen, I'm looking at you. You're what, 72?
No, 73. I'll be 74 next month.
Well, I mean, you look like you're in great health. Your voice sounds great. What's next? What are you going to, you know, what are you going to do now? Are you still touring?
Oh, yeah, still touring. And now we're going to do the book tour. That's going to, you know, I think we got 28 days of that going all over God knows where. and that's just the beginning, so I don't know what's happening. And then, who was that? Some agent called me the day before yesterday about doing a European tour. With Evander Holyfield.
Oh. I hope he's not singing.
I hope he's not singing. Look, I had to do a tour, a mini tour one time with Smokin' Joe Frazier. Oh, that was a trip.
not a great singer. Yeah, I remember him doing his bit on the old Mike Douglas show at one point. So
yeah, did you see that?
Yes, I did. And when you wrote about that, I thought, oh my god.
Oh yeah, I had a show with him in Tiny Tim.
Yeah, that must have been a lot of laughs.
Boy, I've really sunk.
Oh man.
It was a great show, though. It was really a great show. I was surprised, very surprised and happy.
Interesting trio there. Well,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, folks, listen, you can find Gary U.S. Bond's new book, Buy U.S. Bonds, That's My Story, at great online retailers, or you can order it right now at a great price on MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you're watching us on the site, just below us here, somewhere to the left or the right, you'll see a copy of the book. You can just click on the book cover. It'll take you to Amazon. You can order the book right now. It's pain-free. You'll get a great deal, and you should do it. And finally, some money will go into this poor man's pocket, so do it for that reason alone. Gary, do you have a...
Help the poor.
Gary, what I don't know, do you have a website? Are you on social media at all, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, GaryUSBonds.com.
Okay.
And I'm doing, what else are we doing on that? Yeah, GaryUSBonds is the website we have.
All right, we'll make sure to send people there. And
if you go to the website, I'll autograph the book for you if you order from GaryUSBonds.com.
All right, so go to GaryUSBonds.com and order it from him. Don't order it from me. Forget what I said before.
That's you'll fine. Sign it for me.
Or I'll sign it for you. Yeah, I'll sign it. I'll be happy to sign it.
Sure.
Gary, just a pleasure and a delight to talk to you today, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media.
My pleasure, Mr. Media.
Thank you. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening. Today's episode of Mr. Media Interviews is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You know GoDaddy.com from their wild and sexy commercials, but isn't it time you actually test drove their web hosting and domain registration services yourself? For a limited time, Mr. Media listeners can save 10% on the already low price of web hosting services at GoDaddy.com by entering the promo code POD4 at checkout. Again, that's 10% off web hosting when you go to GoDaddy.com and enter the promo code POD4, that's P-O-D, the number 4, at checkout.